Today, the first session we have is actually the conversation with our brother Paul about different aspects of your life. Brother Paul, first of all, welcome to Texas. Is this your first time in Texas?
It is. Assalamu alaikum. It's great to be here.
And have you ever been to America before?
Yes.
Like
Oh,
Shigyasa?
no. No, I've been a lot of, I mean, a number of times, mainly to Chicago, which is my, I'm sorry, it's my favorite American city. I'm sorry.
I
Anyway, moving on quickly. I like California. No, it's my first visit to Texas, though. But it's great to visit the former colonies of Great Britain, and it's good to see you're doing quite well. So congratulations, and I will report back to headquarters to the King of England that you're doing okay. Inshallah.
That was not planned.
No.
Okay. It will be interesting, very interesting. So after Chicago, which is your favorite city, what's your next favorite city in America?
We want to say Dallas, don't you?
Yeah.
I haven't been here long enough. San Francisco is nice, very nice.
Gotcha.
Berkeley, which is not San Francisco but close by, is very nice. I like university cities. Or yeah,
Okay.
there's so much amazing stuff going on in the States. So yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's good. So, Brother Paul, we have seen you on Blogging Theology, inviting different scholars, but very few of us actually know about your story. How did you convert or revert back to Islam? And when did it happen? And last night you were saying something interesting, which actually sparked in my mind that you said, if I'm not mistaken, that you were evangelical fundamentalist.
Oh,
And from
yes.
that, what happened that you ended up here, not only Muslim, but influencing other Muslims to become better Muslim?
Well,
Can you tell?
see, the reason I don't talk about my story very much, because frankly, it's not interesting, is actually very boring. So I'm not keen to inflict this on you, particularly on the morning like this. So it's not very interesting. So I'll give you the extremely brief version. Yeah, there are kind of two conversions in my life. One, when I became a born-again fundamentalist evangelical Christian in my early 20s. Now, that is a conversion because I didn't even believe in God before that. So I moved from an entirely secular worldview with all the attendant moral attitudes to one where I had quite a strict moral code, a definite belief in God's existence. And obviously, but I believe Jesus was God and the Bible was the infallible word of God and so on. So most of the beliefs I had then, I still have now. It's not like I've rejected Christianity in total, because a lot of Christianity is true. And I often think of it like an iceberg. You know, we see the differences above the sea level. You know, oh, that's the bit we don't agree with, which we don't as Muslims. But a lot of it we do. I mean, Muslims and Christians both believe in the day of judgment. They believe that Jesus was a Messiah sent by God. We believe in the Old Testament prophets. We believe in angels and demons, and we believe God created the universe, and so on and so on and so on. There's an awful lot we have in common, actually, compared to any other religion, really. If you think of Hinduism or Shintoism or whatever, you know, they don't believe a lot of that stuff. Yeah, I was very attracted to Christianity by the very loving fellowship, the Christians I knew. I wanted a spiritual path, I didn't know anything about Islam, of course. So I embraced Christianity in that particular form. And I started reading the Bible pretty much straight away, as you do as an evangelical. And that's when the problem started. I kind of noticed things. I mentioned some of them last night. You know, there are passages in the Gospels where Jesus denies he's God, you know, which is a bit embarrassing if you're an evangelical fundamentalist Christian. And that sent me off into researching, looking at what's going on here, you know, Mr. Scholars, how should we interpret this? And then I've discovered other problems which I didn't know about from my reading of the Bible that scholars knew about, to do with the historicity, or the lack of historicity, of the Gospel of John, the Gospel that has the highest Christology, the most exalted understanding of Jesus. And it's nearly universally considered to be the least historical of the Gospels, for very good reasons, actually. So I ended up having this kind of very painful, bifurcated existence as a Christian. On the one hand, I continued to pray and worship as a Christian. I believed the Trinity and everything else. On the other hand, I was becoming increasingly aware of what Christian scholars were saying about Christianity, about the Bible, about manuscripts, about the historical Jesus, the fact that the Trinity, understanding the Trinity didn't exist in the first century, it came about much later. How can that be? You know? And that became more and more painful, psychologically distressing, actually, because I couldn't put down the two issues. I couldn't stop being a Christian, and yet I also was fascinated by the historical figure of Jesus. And this went on for years. You know, I consider in those un-PC days, I consider myself, well, I wouldn't say it now, of course, a disabled Christian.
Disabled Christian?
But well, I couldn't walk properly in my life as a Christian. I was handicapped. Do you know what I mean? It's a metaphor, obviously, a spiritual and intellectual.
It means you didn't get divine guidance properly for the different aspects of your life. Is that what you're referring? You didn't get divine guidance in your different aspects of life.
I sought guidance from my pastor and from books and other Christians, and so it was a journey. It wasn't just like one thing overnight. I realized there was a problem. I constantly wrestling with it and trying to find answers, and not finding answers, and then discovering more problems. And that one day I decided to look to, because I became quite Islamophobic as well, actually.
Wow.
And I, looking back now, racist, I would say, actually, because I was fearful of the increasing demographic presence of Muslims in London, near where I live. And so I thought I would go to my local mosque, Regent's Park Mosque in London. It's interesting, Regent's Park Mosque has a board of trustees, which is not remarkable, but all the trustees are the ambassadors from the Muslim nations. So guess who our treasurer is? He's the Saudi ambassador. And I always laugh. I think, well, there's no chance of us going bankrupt in this mosque. Anyway, so I went there. I literally walked through the doors because I knew the mosque existed because, hey, there's a mosque. I can see it, you know. And I immediately spotted on my right a bookshop. I thought, ha-ha, a bookshop. I can relate to that. So in I went. And I was spotted by some kindly brother who bought me a pile of books. And so that started me in my... I gave myself 3 months to learn all I need to know about Islam. Hilarious, 3 months. And so I read the Quran in English in a dreadful translation. It started... I suddenly realized that there was another parallel religious tradition of, as I thought, of equal profundity and equal... an extraordinary tradition that rivaled Christianity, that spoke also of Jesus as being sent by God. And that was very interesting. Wow, I didn't know that. And that began a discovery that ultimately led to my embracing Islam about a year and a half later, I think. Wow. So I told you it was boring, so...
No, mashallah. Okay, so... how did you start... means one way is... that you accepted Islam, you took Shahada, but now you're not only a Muslim, rather you are influencing other Muslims and other non-Muslim also about the beauty of Islam through blogging theology. So when that idea came that you have to start this channel, and I'm pretty sure there are some people, because your channel is my favorite channel, by the way, on YouTube, mashallah. If you haven't subscribed, just subscribe it. It's very different than other motivational speakers. It's pretty academic-centric. It's like a good resource in the contemporary Islamic epistemology. So now my question to you is, did you get any pessimistic brothers and sisters in your life who told you that, who will going to listen to this two-hour academic video? The attention span is 30 seconds for the Gen Z. And but still, mashallah, you are flourishing. So,
Yeah, it's a good question. To answer that question, we need to go back to the beginning of the channel, which is what, during the COVID lockdown in the UK. We went out into the streets of London. It was like an apocalyptic scene, and there was like no one around. It was really weird. Wow. Because people were encouraged to stay indoors, of course, during COVID. So I bought a new MacBook Pro, and I started making videos just for my own interest. There was no great vision or plan at all, whatsoever. They started becoming increasingly popular, and they're mainly on things that interested me, like the Bible or Christianity or Islam, whatever. And I invited or contacted scholars whose books I had read, inviting them to talk about their books. I really wanted to ask them some questions. And I remember the first one was a guy called Sir Anthony Buzzard, of all things. And he's an American, sorry, he's a British Bible scholar who lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and has been here for many years. And is a Unitarian Christian. So I thought, that's very, very interesting. So he believes in Christianity, but doesn't believe Jesus is God. So I had him on for about, and it was great fun, hour and a half conversation, really loved it. And then I invited someone else, Dominic Crossan, who's actually much more senior, very world-class biblical scholar in the States as well. And he agreed to come on. So great, I can talk about a book I read by him. Now, these videos were, I don't know, an hour or two long, and it really didn't matter what other people thought about that, because I wasn't doing it for anyone else. I was doing it because I wanted to really grapple with the subject matter. And then people did start telling me, but Paul, you know, people's attention span, you know, these days, young people especially don't watch anything for more than 10 minutes. 10 seconds, isn't it? I can't remember if it's 10 minutes or 10 seconds. And I thought, well, that's very interesting, but I really don't care. I don't care. I'm not doing it to reach out to young people. I'm not doing it to be inspirational, as you call it. Ghastly word, inspirational. I'm doing it because I'm interested in the content. And I want to share that content with a few other people, if it is just a few other people. And I'm glad I ignored the advice from wiser people because it was wrong. It was bad advice. And indeed, a lot of young people are interested in serious content that's not just on TikTok or Twitter or something. I remember I did a video with Professor Tupke from Brandeis University on Islam and LGBT, you know, that thing. And I think it was 2 hours long.
Yeah, I think it was 4 hours.
Four hours long, okay. This is breaking all the rules. You don't make four-hour videos with academic videos with professors and expect anyone to watch it on YouTube. Anyway, I think it's had about 250,000 hits so far. And it became, not anything to do with me, but with the professor, an absolute gold standard on this thorough, interesting, balanced, academic understanding of what on earth this LGBT thing is and where did it come from and how are we to understand that as Muslims. And I thought, great. So that's what's what we do, alhamdulillah. And I see myself very often as part of the audience. I'm there to listen and learn and benefit from the guests rather than in any way as their equal. I think with the exceptions where Imam Tom, for example, who I have a huge amount of respect for, I feel, well, because the ages are so, I feel more I can just chat with him and give my uneducated opinion because he's very relaxed, and, which is cool.
That's cool. And I really wish that, inshallah, the channel will have more and more subscribers because it's really beneficial, really, really beneficial. I've heard so many people are getting benefit from that intellectually and emotionally. And that actually, that video from Dr. Sharif sparked me to write the book on Rethinking the Rainbow, which I gave you yesterday. So Brother Paul, by the way, if you are not able to understand the British humor so far, I'm still learning. Yesterday we were in a restaurant and I think Ahmed should be here. His colleague, he's from German. He's doing PhD from Berlin. So he ate the food. Actually, he drank the water and he said, it's very drinkable. And I said, what does it mean? He said, I'm praising. It's awesome. this is the humor in German.
Yeah, in Germany, if you say something, if you were given something like a meal and you say it's not terribly disgusting, it actually means that you like it. So in America, I think you say, oh my God, that's awesome. The most amazing thing I've ever had in my life. And oh my God, you know, about something trivial like an ice cream, you know. In Germany, they say the opposite. Well, that wasn't terrible. And no, I'm not joking. This is what they're like in Germany. So you've got to learn the lingo. They're not being rude. They're actually praising it, you know. Whereas England, we're much better than these two countries. We're in the middle. So we don't overpraise and we don't underpraise. We just say, that was good.
So you're saying moderate nation.
Well, we are the via media. Yeah, we're the middle path.
Ummatan wasata,
England, moderate nation. England is. Yeah.
I think that's pretty ethnocentric, right?
Absolutely. And your point is? Okay, so that's humor.
Okay. Coming back to now one, I would say, serious question, and that is your observation of challenges of Muslims in the West. And I know there are plenty, but I would say few of them which are the biggest challenge right now. What would you say? Because you have seen the other aisle, now you have seen the Muslim community. What are the biggest challenges you see, especially for Muslims in the West?
Oh, I'm not really qualified to speak about that. All I can say is in what I mentioned this last night, I've discovered in the UK and also in France and Germany and Scandinavia is it an extraordinary success story in some ways when it comes to particularly younger Muslims' adherence to the Sunnah, the Prophet, upon him be peace. They're much more committed. This is something I discovered. It's not my opinion. This is well known. Much more committed than their parents, and their parents were more committed than their parents, who were often the first immigrants to, say, the UK. So there's an extraordinary revival of practice and faith amongst Muslims in the West. I don't know about here, though, in the United States. Maybe I'm bracketing that out because I don't know. But in Europe, it's true. And I just thought it was the UK, but it's not. I got a friend of mine, a Swedish scholar, Islamic scholar, living in Saudi Arabia, and he reports the same phenomena in Stockholm and in Denmark and Norway. and it's true in France and Germany as well. So I just want to start by saying that there's some good news. It's not, you know, there are problems, of course, but there's also an amazing success story compared to other religious traditions. Christianity is in free fall in Europe. It really is in terminal decline. It's on its last legs. And I don't like that. I want Christianity to be strong, if only as a bulwark against secularism and this kind of militant secular liberalism that is attempting to change our faith. So there is some good news. Another bit of good news, which I really want to stress, is the quality of dawah in, again, talking about my experience of the UK, compared to even in my short time as a Muslim, say over 10, 11, 12 years. I've seen such an increase in sophistication, in education, in knowledge, in maturity, in good adab. I mean, mention someone like Hamza Zortzis of the Sapiens Institute in England. Very nuanced, sophisticated, intellectually switched on brother who knows his stuff Islamically and the Western tradition. This is amazing, you know, and he's not unique. And he's mentoring others like Muhammad Hijab and many others. So we're seeing a generation of lay ulama, that's not a good expression, but very bright and educated young scholars and others who are engaging and critiquing the West, but not from a purely rejectionist point of view. They are engaging it with nuance and sophistication, but they're faithful to the tradition. They're not liberalizing or modernizing it at all. So it's very encouraging.
That's one thing which you guys in England think about us, if I have not mistaken. I've spoken right now to four different scholars, not you, but four different scholars from England, and they all said that in England, it's at the scholarship level, we have a perception that in America, Muslim, both the scholars and the American Muslim population masses, they tend to liberalize and modernize. And to a certain extent, it's a reality because of certain factors. But what did you notice? Is that a partial reality? Is that something which is actually in America?
Well, yeah, it is. I'm not going to mention names. I really am not going to go there. But I'm going to say some names that I really like. Professor Ali Atai at Zaytuna College in California is, in my humble opinion, an outstanding human being as well as an outstanding scholar. He's a polymath. A polymath is someone who is an expert in many fields. So he's fluent in Biblical Hebrew, New Testament Greek, obviously Arabic. He speaks Farsi. His parents, who I've met, are Farsi speakers. He even speaks English. No, but he's, and he knows Christianity better than most Christian ministers. And obviously he knows Islam. He knows Islamic scholar. So there's some outstanding scholars here, I must say. And he's not unique. There are others associated with Zaytuna, for example. Hassan Spiker, who was on the faculty there, is now moved back to, he's a Cambridge theologian, a philosopher rather, an Englishman. So there are, and there are some other people I won't mention who perhaps are not quite in that class, and not, but I'm not going to ad hominem people, I'm not going to criticize individuals, but so there are some excellent examples of great Islamic scholarship in the States, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Dr. Ali Atai and Hassan Spiker.
Right? Ali Atai, Hassan Spiker, who was on the faculty at Zaytuna, he's now moved back to Amman in Jordan. But he's really worth, he's a brilliant young Islamic scholar. He's written a lot of books on philosophy, on metaphysics, on ethics. His work is difficult to read because it is at a very high intellectual level, but he is, he's interesting, he's a white guy. And I say that because he was born as a Muslim. His parents, one of whom was American, converted in the 1970s. So he was born and brought up as a Muslim in Cambridge in England. But he is a brilliant young scholar, worth watching, following him on Twitter, reading his books. Anyway, those are just two almost random examples. There are others, of course.
Yeah. My brief analysis of why American Muslim community is more left towards, lean towards leftist approach, and you, I just want to ask you if it's the right analysis, is because of, first of all, we are less in population in terms of percentage and more scattered. America is big. So from Seattle to Florida, from, you've already seen that. While in Europe, in England, is everyone in one town. So you would, and one more reason is because of the social pressure. This is imperialism. This is the hub of imperialism. So everything needs to be Americanized. Is that, to a certain extent, right assessment?
I think so. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say Britain is often portrayed as the poodle of the United States. You know, a poodle, these little dogs that follow their owners around. People often say we in Britain are like that vis-a-vis America. And I think, unfortunately, it's true in terms of our foreign policy and everything else. And we're not the only country to be poodles, by the way. There are other. In fact, a lot of the world is like that at the moment. But so it's a bit humiliating for us. But what was your question?
I'm just saying that is this a right reason because of imperial reason and because Muslims are scattered, that's why Muslims...
Well, I was going to say Muslims haven't been here for very long, but that's not true, is it? I mean, Muslims have been here in this land even before the revolution. I mean, in Muslim slaves, of course, in their millions. I mean, there'd be Muslims here. Christians in this country, I assume, don't realize that they think Muslims are just immigrants who've been here for 5 minutes. No, they go back before... Your country was officially broke off from the UK when you did that thing. So you've been around a long time. And I think the problems in America, you're at the epicenter of imperialism. And I would say the epicenter of genocide. This country is the country that supports the genocide of the Palestinians. And that's an unspeakable crime. And I'm sorry to be very critical of your country, but I wish you wouldn't do that. And I wish my government wouldn't do that either, because it's an appalling genocide, and it will go down in history as one of the worst crimes of the 21st century. And the free people of the West, inverted commas, are doing it. So it's unspeakable.
Yeah. Let me ask you the very controversial question.
Good.
Are you... A Ash'ari, Athari, Maturidi, Hanafi, Shafi, Maliki, Hanbali, what are the flavors we have? Who are you?
Yes, is the answer to that question. No, I embraced Islam very much through the Sufi door. I read the works of Guy Eaton, who's a brilliant English writer. I do recommend his work. And when he died several years ago, he'd been a Muslim for 50 years. He was a British diplomat and writer, and he was a scholar in residence at Regent's Park Mosque, where I embraced Islam. And I picked up some bad habits from some of the Sufi Muslims that I knew. By bad, I mean I became in a very ignorant way, reflexingly anti-Salafi. So Salafis are just bad people. They're extremists and horrible. We must attack Salafis and... And I went along with that because I thought that was part of the deal, you know. And then some time ago, there was an incident in my life, which I won't go into here, where two Salafi brothers came to my aid, came to my help. And I learned from them, and these are well-respected Salafi brothers in England, what they really thought, what their attitude was, how they understood Islam. And that began an appreciation, a positive appreciation for the Salafi, not madhab, but the Salafi methodology. I know Salafism is complex internally. There are different groups. But
it's a loaded term.
I'm simplifying. Yeah. I'm simplifying it. And of course, they don't support terrorism. Most of them are quite pacifist. You know, this is the great irony. You know, and so although I still had a positive appreciation for Sufism, I then had a positive appreciation for Salafism. And then I encountered groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is in my country has now been prescribed as a terrorist organization. It's just a political party that campaigns for the caliphate, restoration of the caliphate. And I listened to their arguments and looked into that more. I thought, yeah, they have a good point. Yes, the caliphate is part of our deen, is part of it, the restoration of it. That is mentioned in the hadith, you know. So I thought, yeah, that's I can see the good in that as well. And then I looked in the Ash'ari, the Maturidi, and the Athari, and actually, credit where it's due, I read Sheikh Yasser Qadhi's doctorate on Ibn Taymiyyah, and that opened my eyes up to not just Ibn Taymiyyah's extraordinary epistemology, but also to the Athari creed. And Sheikh Yasser Qadhi argues there, I think, that the Athari was the earliest creed, if you like, rather than the Ash'ari creed came later. So I thought, wow, I didn't know that. And I read Professor Tubki's book on Ibn Taymiyyah, and he corroborated that. So I started identifying as an Athari, and I still do. Even though I identify personally as an Athari, but I'm not anti-Sufi. Some practices are deviant and should be rejected, but broadly speaking, the emphasis on the spiritual and the purification and so on is obviously very good and Islamic. So I end up seeing good in virtually all of these approaches, actually.
Yeah. Which is very good. Which is very good.
But I've been told, well, I think so, I agree, but it feels that I'm being incoherent. People say, well, you can't be pro-Salafi and for the caliphate, because Salafis, I think I can, you know. So I tend to be very eclectic and affirm a lot of different positions.
You know, this is very.
But I have a line. I have a red line, by the way, and that is I don't identify with kind of a more liberal Islam or modernist Islam at all. If so-called Muslims start affirming some of the stuff we see today, then that is for me completely haram. So it's definitely traditional Orthodox in its various permutations.
I really like this approach, because when people revert to Islam, one of the sister I remember in my previous community, she converted to Islam, and I told her, just learn about Islam, keep it easy. And after 2 months, she came to me and she said that Imam Asif, who is this Salafi and Sufi and Deobandi? Am I ignorant if I don't know about them? I said, sister, if you don't know about them, you are protected. but what would be your advice to the whether non-Muslims who are reviving Islam and accept Islam, or even generally a Muslim who is not well-versed about Islam, and then eventually because of social media, information overload, they were going to be exposed to these different Islamic movements. How to have a balanced approach, like take the good and leave the bad, and have the traditional guardrails, so that traditional red line.
Well, my journey is my journey. I'm not saying, by the way, that people should have my views. You know, this kind of very eclectic. I mean, if people want to identify strongly as Salafi, good for them. I'm not going to say, well, perhaps you should be more pro-Sufi. I mean, it's not my business, you know. But I suppose more fundamentally, we should stay in the mainstream of the Sunni, mainstream Sunni orthodoxy. So there are four madhabs. Yes, you can be Ash'arite. Yes, you can be Maturidi. Yes, you can be Athari. It doesn't, in my view, as a layman, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. We're not going to enter Jannah by our views of
Yeah.
It's not that important. I know this, I shouldn't say that, but in my humble opinion, as an ignoramus, it doesn't matter that much, really. I say don't stress about it too much. The things to avoid, though, you know, there are modernists and liberal kind of things and which go under the name of Islam, which we should avoid like a plague.
Very good. I know you love to read books, and I see, mashallah, 4 books in front of us, mashallah. What are you reading these days?
I tend to read a lot. And one of the books I'm reading at the moment, which I do recommend, is called The Unintended Reformation, How a Religious Revolution Secularized Society by Brad Gregory, who is a professor of early modern European history at the University of Notre Dame here in the States. This is an academic work. It's absolutely brilliant. He's a Catholic, but he really, I think, pinpoints some... he's looking into the deep history of the West and how, particularly at the Reformation in the 16th century, in the 1520s, 1530s, how with people like Martin Luther and John Calvin and Zwingli and others, how their protest against the Catholic Church, that's where we get the word Protestant from, their protest against the Church, had an unintended consequence, which he looks at, of the secularization of Europe in France and Germany and England especially. And that was exported ultimately to the States as well. And, you know, these guys, he says, would be horrified to see the world as it is today, where religion is privatized and secularism rules. So it's a brilliant academic work about how the Reformation basically secularized the West. If you want to understand, you want to go deeper into why we are, in some ways, where we are today, this book is very good. I mean, I haven't finished it, but I'm really... A number of Muslim academics are reading it at the moment. Coincidentally, I noticed on Facebook and Twitter they're saying it's Hassan Spiker recommends it highly. He's read it. But I tend to read a handful of books, about 5 or 6 books at the same time. I can't just focus on one. But in the States, I'm just reading this one because I can't do that, read lots of other books at the same time while I'm here.
Oh, mashallah. And since you're reading the books, and nowadays Gen Z are all attached to YouTube and TikTok, like reading the book seems like it's a tradition of the past. What would be your advice to Muslim youth, and especially if you have an Amal program? So Amal program is basically an education program to create more activists. Activists should know about their religion also before they are doing activism.
Yeah.
What would be your advice to Muslim educated youth in this regard?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Very important question. I have some very unusual views by today's standards. I think Muslim youth should read books. You might have seen this before. I didn't get this from a museum, by the way. I actually purchased this from a bookshop. So this is a 3D example of a book. No, seriously, you're not going to get this from TikTok or YouTube or whatever.
Not even from blogging theology?
Not even blogging theology. Although the content then, of course, is excellent. I do recommend that you read books. Now, what books? Because there's some crappy books and there's some good books. I would like anyone, whatever age or generation, to learn about the genealogy of ideas in the West. By the genealogy, I mean the origin, the genesis of the ideas that we breathe like oxygen, as if they're axiomatic, as if they're self-evident. They're not self-evident. They come about, they are the end product, the consequences of a series of historical and intellectual movements which we can identify and map, like this book does, in very particular ways. And the worldview we have in the West today is not natural, it's not universal, although it thinks it is. It's almost accidental. It came about as a byproduct in some of the series of consequences in Europe mainly. So I'd like Muslim youth to dig deep into the history of the Western tradition. I'd like to see us read Plato. Plato was an ancient Greek philosopher in the 4th and 5th centuries BC, 2,500 years ago in Athens, in Greece. one of his pupils was Aristotle, who taught Alexander the Great, of course. Read him. So when I say Plato, but read his Republic. It was a very famous work of his, work of philosophy. Read this stuff, because I know that Plato's Republic is read today in the Ivy League universities in the United States. Undergraduates are reading his work. This guy who lived 2,500 years ago. This still forms minds, young minds, that will end up leading this country. And we've got to understand what's influencing them. Plato's always been read by in the West, by the intelligentsia, by educated people. So learn about the Western tradition, its philosophy, its history, its ideas, where these ideas come from. Learn it for yourself, and don't do it through YouTube, do it through books. So Plato's Republic, but he's written lots of books, but anyway, that's probably the most significant work he wrote. Aristotle, he wrote the Nicomachean Ethics, this amazing book on ethics, which is still hugely influential today in the West, read everywhere. Learn this stuff, become acquainted with it, appreciate it, but also critique it from the Islamic point of view. Also Christianity, learn about Christianity. I don't mean from YouTube, from social media. There are some common mistakes that even Muslim scholars routinely make about Christianity, which is embarrassing, really, because they're quite elementary mistakes. So there's a common idea around the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. So there's a bunch of bishops that met in what is now Turkey in the 4th century. It's called the Council of Nicaea, called by Constantine, the Roman Emperor, to settle a question about who Jesus really was. Was he the same as God, like God, or was he God himself? So they decided that Jesus was God, basically. It's a Nicene Creed. But I keep on hearing this idea that Nicaea was about the Trinity. No, he wasn't. Doesn't mention the Trinity. Nothing to do with the Trinity. Never came up. I also hear that Nicaea was the time when they decided which books would go into the Bible or something, or which Gospels would be chosen. That's simply not true. That's a Da Vinci Code Dan Brown myth. Da Vinci Code is a book that was written several years ago that a work of fiction. He says it was a work of fiction and made up stories. But these ideas have become quite popular. We need to educate ourselves about what Christianity really is. And not make these elementary mistakes, which are often recycled. I could go on about that. So learn about real Christianity from good academic books like The Historical Figure of Jesus by E.P. Saunders, professor at Duke. This is another one of my favorite by Ahmed Porkila. He's a senior fellow at Cambridge University. He's an English Muslim. Rethinking Islam and the West, a New Narrative for the Age of Crises. He's in his 80s now, but this is a really well-received book amongst Muslim educators and instructors. Very, very good. Again, going deep into the history of the West intellectually. Why we think the way we do now. Where do these ideas of autonomy, individual autonomy come from? Liberalism. You know, there are identifiable people like John Locke, the father of liberalism. He's actually much better known in the US, by the way, than he is in England, where he was from. You know, he invented this idea of tolerance and secularism. It's there in his Second Treatise of Government, which I recommend. His letter on tolerance is, you know, this influenced the American Declaration of Independence, which quotes him. He's an English philosopher from the 17th century. We as Muslims need to know about these guys. So that we're not passively influenced by the zeitgeist, these ideas. We can critically resist them, analyze them, and from our own Islamic tradition. So the second point is to know our Islamic tradition well. You know, so great teachers like Sheikh here, but we also need to read people like Ibn Taymiyyah, Al-Ghazali, this is very long. So we need to educate ourselves in both traditions, so that we can robustly analyze and critique them, but remain faithful to our own tradition. Otherwise, we're going to go under. We're just going to end up repeating what Fox News says and all that rubbish, you know. Anyway.
Rubbish or garbage?
Garbage, I mean.
Okay.
It's English, actually, garbage.
I actually like the last point you mentioned. I didn't, of course, I like the first one also. This American humor. Oh, no, I'm kidding. That, you know, sometimes you have the knowledge of your enemy more than the knowledge of what you hate but not the knowledge of what you love. So it is very important to have the knowledge of Western philosophy to deconstruct these ideologies and isms and ologies. But having said that, if you don't have proper knowledge of the text and the rational sciences of Islam and textual sciences of Islam, then eventually you won't have traditional guardrails. So I'd really like two-point advice. First is to get well-versed in the philosophy and the comparative religion, including Christianity, but have the traditional guardrails, because otherwise it's very easy, because philosophy without traditional knowledge can take you to a skepticism route or agnosticism route, but if you have a traditional guardrails, then you know how to take the good and wise things and how to critique the problematic things from an Islamic lens.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. Yeah, I was assuming someone was well-grounded in their own tradition, but you're absolutely right. We need to identify good scholars. We need to read their work, follow them, listen to them. In England, we have people like Abdul Hakim Murad, Dr. Tim Winter. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with everything he says, but I'm just pointing to senior ulama who are acknowledged and accessible and written a lot. And we need to be very educated in our own tradition as well, not just the opposition's tradition. So yeah, it's quite a task. I'm not saying, by the way, that everyone should do this. I think it really is quite elitist what I'm saying. I don't think everyone should read philosophy. It's difficult. It's demanding. It's very rewarding. It's very necessary to read it. But I'm saying a group of us should do it and then share that information perhaps in another way with other people. But I'm not saying everyone should do this, actually. And it is elitist. A very un-American thing to say, I'm sure. But anyway, or maybe not, I don't know.
Okay. No. Let's conclude this with a final discussion. I asked this last night, and you briefly touched it. Post-October 7th, we have seen our Muslim community, especially in America, but even in European Muslim community, we were swinging, especially here, swinging like pendulum between the left and the right. Pre-October 7th, we came a little bit to the center in our approach, whether it's the sexuality issues or other issues. And October 7th happened, and now we are pushed towards the fences, it seems like. So are you concerned that this social justice movement, because this happened to Christianity 100 years ago, that Christianity turned into a social justice movement and it lost its essence. It became like a Marxist social justice. Are you concerned that the same thing might happen? Or maybe we are smart now how to basically tackle, because post 9/11, the same challenge came and we learned from our mistakes. What is your take on that?
Wow, that's a huge question. I was in front of the White House several days ago when we were in Washington, and there was a pro-Palestinian demonstration happening there. I think it was led or initiated by revolutionary socialists. There's a particular left-wing party. I forget who they are. Anyway, but there were Muslims present. And I think that there's the issue of how we behave in these demonstrations. What is the adab that Muslims should adopt? Can we shout and scream at our enemies? Can we abuse them? Can we say, can we do behavior that leads to our arrest by the police? How do we, how should we behave distinctly Islamically? I mean, because the left, some of the left will perhaps overstep the mark. They'll be even violent sometimes, abusive or aggressive towards the police or whatever. So I think we need to be much more aware of how we should behave Islamically in these. I'm not saying we shouldn't go on demonstrations. I'm saying, well, if we do, how we should behave Islamically, and not just adopt the patterns of behavior of the left. And of course, the left have their own agenda. They have their political, revolutionary, secular agenda, which is often Marxist, by the way, which is atheist, explicitly anti-religion. Although they might keep that a bit quiet if they've got Muslim allies around, but
some scholars, not from traditional perspective, but let's say some movement-oriented, how to say, if not as scholars, Moors and Shakers of Muslim community, might say that Marx have the same approach, even though I agree with you, but I'm just trying to give you a pushback from their angle. They might say that Marx have the clash between the haves and have-nots, the oppressed versus oppressor, and Islam talk about this from a different angle. So what's wrong with it? We have our own epistemology. If something good is coming, we need to take... So Marx, one of the scholar 100 years ago, without taking his name, and he said that Marx plus Islam is the solution for the humanity. Yeah. And if I'll tell you the name... no, I can't. I'm pretty sure that at that time it was different. Now more researches have been done on Marx. Now scholars won't make this mistake. But where to identify that Marxist social justice, and the term social justice in and of itself, yeah, goes against the divine system of justice.
I agree. I think Marxism is an atheistic, godless, materialist ideology. We must be very clear about that. Now, there may be some of the aspirations which are good. I mean, not everything in National Socialism, you know, that he believes in, you know, extending the working wage to, you know, living working wage and giving workers holiday. Most ideologies have some good in them, but we shouldn't necessarily, you know, get in bed with them, so to speak, or form alliances with. Marxism aims explicitly to the abolition of religion as such. It's not just atheist, it actually wants to abolish religion. I mean, Marx said so. These people can't be really our allies. There might be coincidental overlaps between our agendas, but that's about it. So no, Islam can't be combined with anything else. It is the divine dispensation for man, for the human race. But I think the whole alliance, the Muslim alliance with the left in general, is highly problematic because it often comes at a price where we have to perhaps either be quiet about our core Islamic beliefs, say on gender or marriage or LGBT, whatever. We either self-censor or we get criticized by the left for having these views. And with the right, some Christian right have good values about family values, for example, that the importance of faith in life, in public square. There should be faith in the public square and so on. But the right often are allied with, in this country anyway, Zionism and with Islamophobic attitudes and so on. So I think maybe we need to form strategic partnerships or ad hoc alliances, but not actually have a built-in alliance with, say, the Labour Party in Britain or the Democrat. Well, I can't tell you what to do, but there needs to be more independence, I think, and critical interaction, and we need to build up our own base, I think.
Yeah, actually, very, very true.
إِنَّ الْمُسْلِمِينَ وَالْمُسْلِمَاتِ وَالْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتِ وَالْقَانِتِينَ وَالْقَانِتَاتِ وَالصَّادِقِينَ وَالصَّادِقَاتِ وَالصَّابِرِينَ وَالصَّابِرَاتِ وَالْخَاشِعِينَ وَالْخَاشِعَاتِ والخاشعين والخاشعات والمتصدقين والمتصدقات والصائمين والصائمات والحافظين فروجهم والحافظات والذاكرين الله كثيرا والذاكرات أعد الله لهم مغفرة وأجرا عظيما.